Today marks the opening of the International Climate Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark, which will run through December 18th, and we will focus more on the issues of climate in the next couple of weeks. But this past week also marked the 10-year anniversary of the World Trade Organization's meeting in Seattle, which was met by 50,000 protesters against corporate globalization. We certainly expect citizen and activist presence and demonstrations in Copenhagen, and we're going to look back at Seattle and the 10 years in between with two guests who played important roles. First, I'll be joined by Norm Stamper. He was Seattle's police chief at the time and oversaw the police response to the demonstrations. We talk with him about those events and about his life and work in the decades since, which will probably surprise those of you who confronted his forces in 1999. My second guest will be Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange and founder of the Green Festivals. Kevin was intimately involved in organizing for the Seattle WTO teach-ins and protests and co-edited Globalize This, the Struggle Against the World Trade Organization and Corporate Rule. Let me read just a bit from a story in the New York Independent this week by Mark Engler entitled The Battle in Seattle at 10. Did the 1999 protests against the World Trade Organization actually make a difference? The protests, a massive grassroots effort by unions, environmentalists, organic farmers, solidarity, activists, and diverse community groups, made headlines around the world. They marked the beginning of a new phase of popular mobilization around issues of corporate power and international trade. They even inspired a 2008 film dramatization, Battle in Seattle, which featured Hollywood stars Woody Harrelson, Michelle Rodriguez, Charlize Theron, and Andre 3000. But in the long run, did the protests promote meaningful change? Well, in assessing any single historical incident, this question's a difficult one. Generally speaking, the response of many Americans is to dismiss protests out of hand, arguing that demonstrators are just blowing off steam and won't make a difference. But if any case can be held as a counterexample, Seattle is it. While the demonstrations were still playing out and police were busy arresting some 600 people, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman issued his now-famous edict stating that the deluded activists were just flat-earth advocates looking for their 60s fix. While cynicism comes cheap, those concerned about global poverty, sweatshop labor, outsourced jobs, and threats to the environment can witness remarkable changes in the international scene. Today, trade talks at the WTO are in shambles. Sister institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have been knocked from their once imposing pedestals. And the ideology of neoliberal corporate globalization is under intense fire, with mainstream economists defecting from its ranks and entire regions such as Latin America in outright revolt. As global justice advocates have long argued, the forces that created these changes did not start in Seattle, yet few trade observers would deny that the week of protests late in the last millennium marked a critical turning point. And before I bring Norm Stamper on, I realize I haven't said a word yet about the expected decision earlier this week of Barack Obama to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. All I want to say about that is that it deeply saddens me. Having had Matthew Ho, the Marine vet who quit his post in the Foreign Service in Afghanistan, having decided that we're engaged in a civil war, having had Malai Joya on the show, a member of parliament at the age of 23 who's been banned from parliament for saying warlords shouldn't be seated and who says that the government which we are siding with is not worth that risk we're taking. As I just say, it saddens me, and I just say, as with everything we're watching these days from D.C. and from the Obama administration, it is up to us to do everything we can to follow perhaps the model of those folks in Seattle, but to do everything we can to make this government represent us the way we wish. Norm Stamper began his law enforcement career in 1966 in San Diego as a beat cop and later led San Diego Mayor Pete Wilson's Crime Control Commission. He served as Seattle's chief of police, as I said, but that was from 1994 until his resignation in 2000. He's currently a speaker for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, a 10,000-member organization representing cops, judges, prosecutors, FBI, DEA agents who advocate the legalization and regulation of drugs. Stamper's the author of Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. Welcome, Norm Stamper.
Thanks very much, Terrence. Good to be with you.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So we're going to deal with Seattle, and we're going to deal with the 10 years since. But can you tell us a little bit about your life prior to that week in 1999?
Well, how far back do you want to go?
Well, I mean, just what led you to law enforcement, and what had your experience been, and you know, who was Norm Stamper before people suddenly said, that's Norm Stamper?
Well, I was one of four boys in the Stamper family, and with the exception of the youngest, the sons of Everett Eugene Stamper got beaten around pretty good by their old man, beaten and bloodied on a number of occasions. And that puts me in league with a whole lot of other families, of course, but I grew up in an abusive environment. I had opposition to, and if not real animosity toward the police before I became a police officer. I had had a number of run-ins with them, and I had seen racism and brutality up close. I'd also seen apathy and neglect. I got burglarized three times when I was living and working at the National City Pet Hospital. That's just south of San Diego. And I got 100 rhythm and blues and R&B and jazz albums stolen, and it was just devastating. And I remember to this day what it felt like to feel that my life had been violated, and that's something that was very precious to me, taken away from me. So for a variety of reasons, I didn't have a whole lot of use for the police, but I got married at 20. And working and living at a pet hospital was fine until I got married. And then it became clear that we really needed to move out of that tiny apartment. And that meant I needed another new day job. I was playing rhythm and blues in a band three or four nights a week to supplement my income. And so I traded all of that for this police job in San Diego. I accompanied a friend who wanted to be a cop since he was three, and I was just going to sit under a eucalyptus tree in Balboa Park and wait for him to finish the test. And the person who was proctoring the exam asked if I was interested, and I of course turned around, looked over my shoulder to see who she was talking about. Long story short, I took the test, I passed, he failed, and I became a cop. And if anything, I guess I would characterize it as accidental, but I think it's important to point out that almost from the moment that I became a San Diego police officer, I was sucked into the cop culture. And within a year, I was doing and saying things I'd never said or done before, and they weren't good things. And I was, in effect, abusing the people I had been hired to serve. I got slapped upside the head by a principled prosecutor who asked me if the Constitution meant anything to me. This was about 14 months on the job, and after I came down from my rage and my embarrassment, I was just saturated in shame.
And how long was that into your career?
14 months into my career. My entire rookie year, I did some good things, and I'm not, too immodest, and I'm happy to say that I helped people. I stopped people from hurting other people. I did a number of things that I think were honorable, but I also did an awful lot of things that were not. And then once I came to grips with the fact that that I had in fact allowed myself to be sucked into this culture and say and do those things that I'd never said or done before, I realized that what I wanted my career, if I was going to stay in police work, to be all about was changing the institution and attacking the institutionalized as well as the individual racism and sexism and homophobia and tendencies toward brutality and for that matter a slower and more apathetic response in economically disadvantaged neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color.
So that really sets an interesting context, and obviously I've read enough to know that your career was about trying to shift that culture and shift the way that the police behave toward those they are to serve and protect. And I will tell people the book Breaking Rank is worth reading. You seldom will find someone opening the window sort of on what the police lifestyle, the police culture is like. And Norm Stamper from those beginnings as a playing blues and living in a pet hospital became, as I said, a leader in the San Diego force and then the chief of the Seattle force, and grabbed a PhD along the way as well. So a book well worth reading. Let's jump now, if we can, to the protests and the response. Something like 50,000 demonstrators descend on Seattle to confront and, if possible, shut down the WTO meetings. What did you expect and what had you planned for?
We expected tens of thousands of people. We expected largely nonviolent demonstrations over the course of the week. We had, because we had met with demonstration leaders, protest leaders, in advance of that week, to create help to create an opportunity for civil disobedience arrests and actually to do what we could to facilitate free expression and particularly demonstrators' rights to assemble and to express themselves. And we also obviously had an obligation to protect the WTO ministers. And we put 10,000 hours worth of training and planning into the event, but clearly we were not prepared for what did happen. And we made mistakes, made a number of mistakes in planning and preparation and during that week as well.
Okay, so and I remember at the time I was in Seattle that week, and I remember reading about the enormous amounts of preparation you'd done. So where did all that preparation and the planning, and as you say, you expected a lot of people and so on, where did it break down? Did it break down at the top, the bottom, both?
Yes. I think in truth what happened is that we knew this was going to be big. We believed that it would certainly be the biggest protest that Seattle had seen, certainly dating back to the 60s with campus unrest and anti-war demonstrations and so forth. So we knew it was going to be big. We knew there would be some violence. We knew that we would make some arrests. But I think where it broke down, and I'll just own this myself, is in our naivete. We had not had anything resembling a violent protest. Anarchists had generally skirted the city. They'd show up from time to time and much, much smaller protests. And we would make a handful of arrests, typically, many of those directed at police brutality and other concerns about police practices. And we also believed that what we had seen in the history of the WTO, of course, dating back to its earlier incarnation as GATT, the violence in Geneva, I think that was something like a year, year and a half before, but we attributed that to a European phenomenon. And we had basically convinced ourselves that we wouldn't see what we did see on our streets with a very concerted effort to literally shut the conference down, simply because that hadn't happened in a long, long time in this country. We also undervalued, I think, the organizing power of the Internet, and for that matter, of cell phones. This was the first major protest in American city that was essentially organized by means of much higher technology than existed in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And we failed to grasp just how powerful that mechanism is. Looking back on it, obviously, tremendous respect for the organizing that did take place.
Yeah, I mean, that's for others of us, I suppose, than those who are in your position, looking at it. In retrospect, it was just very, very well organized. And it seems that, I mean, your assumption, as you say beforehand, your original analysis that it would be a lot of people and that there might be some anarchists. The anarchists actually were I believe, were from Oregon. So they were close by. Now, the anarchists, it seems to me, as I say, I was there, were the only ones really doing violence. And how many of them were there? How big a role did they play? And let me put it this way. From your point of view, in the protest, in the police response, and in the media portrayal.
We did have every reason to believe that the so-called Eugene anarchists would, in fact, come to Seattle and work their magic. We had a wonderful opportunity, frankly, speaking now from a tactical point of view, to deal with them early on, but we did not. They had taken over a building. A vacant building, very close, by the way, to the West Precinct headquarters. And a conscious decision was made, particularly because of the number of personnel that we had, that we would allow them to occupy that building because we'd at least be able to monitor their comings and goings. Turns out, I think, that was a bad decision.
In other words, that you could have had them on that violation and preemptively held them prior to the demonstrations ever starting?
Well, of course, the problem there is that it's a misdemeanor. It's a vacant building. It's not a burglary. They didn't break in to steal anything. And one consequence of the charging reality is that they'd be out on the streets in no time anyway.
Right.
But they were clearly the ones, as you pointed out, and as you observed, who early on were committing the destructive acts, newspaper racks through windows and some looting and things of that nature. How many? Dozens? Maybe 100? Maybe 200? I don't really know for sure. By definition, anarchists
sure
don't play by the rules.
That's right.
And there were many, many anti-globalization protesters who were trying to do what they could to rein them in. And some of these included people who were bent on closing down the conference itself. So, you know, in that sense, we were set up as opponents. The police required to keep the venue open and to allow the demonstrators to assemble and express themselves. But when you start talking of strategy or tactics of actually ending an event, which I clearly understand for political reasons, then you're going to be in opposition of the police. And what happened on the second morning of that week, and I was present at the time, at the intersection, was probably our biggest mistake of the week. And what we did, long story short, is attempt to reclaim an intersection that had been occupied by non-violent demonstrators. And we made a decision. My field commander made the decision. I embraced it and supported it, to use chemical agents after a number of warnings. The theory being that we really needed that intersection clear because of its strategic importance to downtown and to the venues, the various venues being used by the World Trade Organization. If for no other reason that somebody might be in need of emergency services and we wouldn't be able to get to them. So the cop in me supported this decision to use tear gas. The police chief in me should have vetoed that decision. But it wasn't, Terrence, until 5 years later, as I'm on book tour and I'm listening to a lot of people who came to Seattle, that I changed my position on that. It seemed like the only thing we could do at the time. We were heavily outnumbered. We had other contingents of demonstrators who were moving in from 3, 4, 5 different other locations to this precise location, and felt that we really needed that intersection cleared before they arrived. So, long story short, we did something we ought not to have done, and I think it had the effect of making more militant the tactics of many of the demonstrators. I think it introduced what I would call recreational rioting, on the part of people who had been maybe sitting in a bar and nursing a beer and a shot and deciding they want to get in on the fun. So we had a number of folks who were not really anti-globalization advocates so much as people who were simply attracted to the adventure of the week. And they joined the anarchists, I think, in committing some of the most violent and destructive acts.
Right. So in other words, what you're saying there is that the decision to unleash tear gas to keep an intersection open, over again, what you'd do is you'd sacrifice the logistical smoothness of keeping that open and try to tamp down rather than escalate the confrontation.
Well, and I wouldn't even use the word tamp down. I think had we simply allowed those protesters to occupy that intersection essentially for as long as they wanted, eventually they would move on to another location or what have you, was a huge mistake. That, you know, your decisions you make that favor action and others that favor restraint. I favored action at the time. I will take that regret to the grave. I think that morning tipped the scales for a whole lot of people, and the focus became the excessive force of the Seattle Police Department.
All right. And that led to your resignation some months afterwards.
Well, a day after.
God, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, my intention was to retire in 2000. And, of course, this was in December of 1999. It was very evident to me that we had made mistakes, that I personally had made mistakes. So on Saturday of that week, I announced to the mayor that I would, in fact, be stepping down. And my motive bluntly, was to the extent possible, take my tenure off the table, depoliticize the thing, and accept responsibility. I don't think you just accept responsibility and walk away. So it, you know, it's very important that the debriefing and the critiquing and whatever hand-wringing and teeth-gnashing was necessary in the weeks and months following that week, that it needed to play out without any regard for my tenure. I had taken my future, if you will, off the table.
Very good. I understand that. Okay, and so then your focus these days seems to be your work with LEAP, the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. How did that come about, and what's your work entail? What's the response of the rest of law enforcement? I'll ask some questions as you go on.
Okay. I included a chapter in my book. The chapter on World Trade Organization battle in Seattle is called Snookered in Seattle. That refers to us. I also wrote another chapter whose title, I think, was Wage War Against Crime, Predatory Crime, not Drugs. When Richard Nixon declared war on drugs in 1971, he, in a very calculated and cynical way, declared war on his own people. I think that was his true and at least original impeachable offense. We have spent $1 trillion prosecuting that war, incarcerated tens of millions of Americans for nonviolent drug offenses, wildly disproportionate numbers of whom are young and poor and of color. We have fragmented families, we have ruined lives, and to what end? Drugs are more readily available today at lower prices and higher levels of potency than when that war, ostensibly against a substance or a series of substances, was declared. We have also seen the reality that prohibition gives rise to crime, to violence, to corruption. And what's happening along the Mexican border and deep into the interior of Mexico is testament to that. We are seeing tortuous, violent crimes being committed by the drug cartels, beheadings, people thrown onto burning tires, kidnappings, extortion, robbery, murder, as I obviously have already mentioned. It's just a horrible situation, and it's a direct product of the American drug war, whose organizing principle is prohibition. And prohibition simply does not work. So it is our view, it's my view certainly, that the drug war has caused far more harm than good, that what's needed is a decision to end the drug war yesterday, stop throwing $69-70 billion a year at it every year, convert our drug policy along the lines of a public health model, mm-hmm. and legalize all drugs.
Now, that's interesting, by the way. I end up dealing with this issue a few times a year, and most people, it's interesting, who are even, the activists in the drug policy think tanks and the drug policy advocacy organizations, not even that many of them will say legalize them all. And yet you do. Two things. One, do you think the fact that you were in law enforcement makes it easier for you to do that? And have you come to that gradually?
No, I have actually not come to it gradually. I took this position, in a very unformed way early in my career. And when I got to Seattle in the early 90s in San Diego, I was now speaking out against the drug war and the need. I misused the word decriminalization, which is, of course, the position of many in the drug policy reform movement. Decriminalization is good to the extent that it helps users, and for that matter, abusers, creates somewhat less of a stigma. It's still considered wrong. It still imposes a fine. But it doesn't attach a criminal record, and all of that is good as far as the users are concerned. It does nothing about the supply side. It does nothing about the crime and the violence and the fact that so many users have to steal in order to finance their next fix or deal drugs themselves or prostitute themselves.
So let me just interrupt for a second,
sure.
And we're going to wrap very, very soon.
Sure.
You made that nuance clear to me. In other words, decriminalization, it is still something that enforcement has to deal with and that cannot be proper regulated by the government, let's say, in that setting. So, it, as you say, it's relief for users, but it's many of the other problems still persist, and so that's why you go all the way to legalization and regulation?
Well, I go to legalization and regulation because we have a choice, as I see it. Either we can leave the regulation of the currently monopolized illicit drug market, a $500 billion global industry, in the hands of drug cartels and street dealers, or we can put it in the admittedly imperfect hands of government along the lines of tobacco and alcohol. We would then provide through taxation, through revenues, an opportunity for people who need help to get help.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap it there. You know, it's gone by very, very quickly, Norm Stamper, and perhaps we may do this again at some point and go in a little more deeply into what the ramifications of legalization and the process would look like. But I've been speaking with Norm Stamper, former Seattle police chief, author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing, spokesman for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You can learn more at normstamper.com and also at LEAP. That's LEAP.cc. Thank you, Norm Stamper. Keep up the good work, and we'll be right back with Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange and the Green Festivals. He was a leader of the International Forum on Globalization, a lead organizer of the protests and demonstrations, and a very wise man to my ears. Thanks a lot, Norm Stamper.
Thank you very much.
Now, you recall at the top of the show, I read from an article this week in New York's Independent, looking back at the battle in Seattle. Well, I saved this for now. Here's the opening lines of that article. 10 years ago this fall, Kevin Danaher, the bareheaded, white-goateed co-director of Global Exchange, was making the rounds to student groups, encouraging young people to join in upcoming protests against the World Trade Organization. He'd worked up a theatrical pitch. How many people here are at Woodstock? He would ask, and with his own hand raised, look over his audiences. Only me, huh? Well, that's too bad for you. But if you want to be part of something equally important and historic, get your ass to Seattle. Before the fact, and amid an era of celebration for corporate globalization, this prediction of the action's magnitude seemed exaggerated at best. Afterwards, not so much. Kevin Danaher is the co-founder of Global Exchange, founder and executive producer of the Green Festivals, executive director of the Global Citizen Center. He was also the founding board chair of Transfair USA, the fair trade certifying agency for the U.S. He received his Ph.D. in sociology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. And he's the author and or editor of 13 books, including Globalize This, The Battle Against the World Trade Organization and Corporate Rule, 50 Years is Enough, The Case Against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, The Green Festival Reader, Fresh Ideas from Agents of Change, and Building the Green Economy, Success Stories from the Grassroots. And those last two are both in the last couple of years. Welcome once again, Kevin Danaher.
Well, thanks, Terrence. I love being on Pacifica. It's our kind of people.
Exactly. Now, as I just reminded the audience, you know, it's the 10-year sort of anniversary of Seattle, so Norm Stamper was the start, and you're the finish. And first of all, let me just jump completely. Woodstock, how old were you?
I was 19, and we thought it was just going to be a concert, and it changed our lives because it showed us that hundreds of thousands of people can come together and love each other and be nice. And in a sense, it laid the basis in my consciousness for eventually producing the Green Festivals, because it's a very similar principle. You get thousands of people together with a common vision. Let's create the next economy from the bottom up. Let's not wait for the leaders on top. They're not going to bring it to us. We got to do it ourselves. And that spirit's out there in the land now and spreading rapidly.
Very good. And so this was, what's interesting is when you say it that way, is that when you were saying that to those students in 1999, you weren't merely saying, you know, goosing them so they'd show up. You actually had experienced that feeling that you were trying to get them to get.
Yeah, I wasn't just BSing them. I mean, it was a useful marketing tactic, because on the streets of Seattle 10 years ago, there were these young people that came up, "Hey, dude, I came because you came to our college and told us, oh, man, this is great." You know? So it did work. And irony of ironies, that same building that we blockaded and tanked the WTO from doing their meetings there, we now rent that facility for the Seattle Green Festival.
Oh,
And just a little background on that. I went in early, as soon as we found out that that was the venue, I went in a nice suit and said, "I'm thinking of renting this facility for my trade association. Could I have the floor plans?" So we knew every entrance and exit of the building. We knew what there were 13 intersections we had to blockade. And we did training camps where people were briefed on, and we had recon teams that went out and took photographs of all the different entrances and exits in the streets, and, you know, this one we need 50 people, this one we need 200 people. So it was almost like a little bit of of a military operation in terms of the planning and the training. But we showed that grassroots mass mobilizing with a nonviolent, with a strictly nonviolent ethical base can work. It's the way to go. Armed struggle, you know, you look at those armed struggle movements that we supported over the years, the liberation movements, they came to power and didn't do so well in a lot of cases.
That's so. Right. Well, there's a movie out right now on the Biedermannhoff gang.
Yeah.
Which, as you just, I just saw the trailer the other day, and it's like, oh my God. Yeah. No, and what you're saying actually is that, I mean, for anyone who didn't quite catch the nuance there, you're saying that you dressed in your suit and said your trade association was interested in it prior to Seattle. The truth is you were telling the truth. It's just you were about 8 years.
Exactly. We were just a little bit ahead of ourselves. Just like Global Citizen Center, the idea is to take the Green Festival set of relationships. Green Festival is just a platform. We spent a lot of money renting the facility and organizing it so that all of these green companies and green educators and green nonprofits can come together, same place, same time, and cross-fertilize and realize no matter how good your organization is, you have to get beyond your corporate ego, your institutional ego, and subordinate that institutional ego to the movement-building effort. And that's the basic idea of the Global Citizen Center, is to take that weekend event platform into a real estate model. If you look at these downtown buildings, you got, you know, 30, 40 stories of offices above a ground floor retail. Is there any integration of those tenants into one fist? No. It's really stupid because all of those office tenants are putting out email, newsletter, website. They could all say, come to this address, and then benefit and share in the benefits of the ground floor retail. Our two stores in Washington, D.C. and Virginia, we're in restaurants called Bus Boys and Poets. And Andy Shalal, the guy that produces Bus Boys and Poets, he's got a bunch of them now. He always has an event space in the back of the restaurant, and he lets movement groups use it for free. So his restaurant becomes the hangout. And then our fair trade stores benefit from all that traffic, and it's just a nice collaborative process.
So Global Exchange now has fair trade stores?
We have them in San Francisco, Berkeley, Portland, D.C., and Virginia, just outside D.C.
Mm-hmm. Well, L.A. would be prime territory.
And the good thing about a store is it brings in people off the street who,
right,
they're not going to come to one of my lectures. They're not going to buy some radical book trashing corporations, but they'll come in because they see some beautiful tchotchke in the window. Well, it turns out that tchotchke was made by a handicapped group in Kenya or a women's group in El Salvador who don't want charity. They want access to markets so they can earn their way out of poverty. It's a much more dignified way to eliminate poverty than waiting for the generosity of rich people.
Yeah, I saw a documentary on the whole fair trade movement, and I'm forgetting what the fair trade, free trade, or I mean, what was it? You know the one I'm talking about. But I was so impressed by it. In other words, I do my little thing here and there with, you know, this object, that, but it just made so much sense to me.
Yeah,
that this is the, you know, those who have and have a little more than they expected to have. This is probably the simplest way for them to change the way things are. One thing that I also discovered in prepping for this was that a year after the week in Seattle, I did a show to look back at it, and you were my guest that week, too. So, and here 10 years later.
Hey, everybody makes mistakes.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So just so people can place it in context, because we're going to look at a lot of what you've done over the 10 years since, but what was your role in those events, and how long did you work on it?
Well, I was doing at the time, I was writing books about the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, these big global institutions that control billions of dollars and really write the rules for the global economy. And I was raised Catholic on this tradition of Jesus Christ. And Jesus was a very nonviolent guy. He was like granddaddy of the nonviolence movement, yet he got violent one time. And what profession did he pick? Was it tax collectors? No. Was it soldiers? No. It was bankers. The money changers in the temple. And he threw their stuff on the ground. He said, you're defiling God's house. So who runs the planet right now? It's bankers. Are they defiling God's house? You bet they are. So I was coming at it from, you know, sort of my roots as young Christian Marxist radical community activist. And I said, okay, wait a minute. You know, this World Trade Organization institution based in Geneva, Switzerland, which nobody knows anything about, they are writing a constitution for the entire planet. And people, human rights activists and environmentalists do not have a seat at the table. Small farmers, women, et cetera, don't have a seat at the table. The only people with a seat at the table are corporate trade lawyers. And the whole purpose is to prevent you and I, just regular folks, from erecting barriers in our local economy to outside corporations coming in and extracting wealth. And if you're a transnational corporation, your only purpose in setting up an operation, whether you're Walmart, Home Depot, whatever, if you're going to go into a local economy, your presupposition is that you can extract more wealth than you're going to invest. Otherwise, why would you do it? So it's a colonial model. It's an extractive model.
Let me cut in 1 second, Kevin, and tell people that we did a show last week, I think, on the film The End of Poverty.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen the film, and it does come to your city, check it out, because it really does look at this very things Kevin's talking about in some depth, taking it right back to colonialism. And if you can't get it in the theater near you, wait till it comes out on DVD.
It's a great film. It's actually just started here in San Francisco, and I'm speaking Saturday night after the 8:25 showing. And we now have the evidence that the existing system doesn't work for the majority of people, but it also doesn't work for the environment. Every biological system on the face of the earth is collapsing, whether it's fish catch, topsoil, water, fossil fuels, ocean levels rising. Houston and Miami are going to go underwater. That's guaranteed. That's not me speculating. That's science. That's proven. And that's going to happen no matter what we do, even if we were to jam on the brakes with CO2 methane production. So that is going to push consciousness and capital and jobs in a green direction. So I just came from meetings here in San Francisco where the city government, city college, the nonprofit groups were all coming together to create green job training, green job placement, green job creation. And what you find is the people who need that green job training and the green jobs the most happen to live in the neighborhoods where the buildings need uplift the most and where it's low-hanging fruit. The most inefficient buildings is the low-hanging fruit. That's where you can make your greatest cost savings.
Right.
So
and
it's a nice coincidence.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, as you know, you and Dan Jones and others point out, you cannot outsource retrofitting.
Yep.
It has to be done.
And weatherization and efficiency in buildings is where the most federal money is coming. The Obama administration has made big commitments. There's a thing called the Emerald Cities Coalition, where select cities are being encouraged to bring together government, nonprofits, and green companies, and there will be federal money for that. So, you know, we criticize the Afghanistan policy and all that, but in terms of the stimulus getting down to the grassroots, we are managing to do that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The place, it seems to me, where it's happening the most is where it comes together with green.
Yeah. Yeah, because everybody's realizing now, they just had American Institute of Architects just had, for example, a contest here in the Bay Area, $10,000 prize for who could ever come up with the best plan for dealing with ocean level rise in the Bay Area. You're talking about trillions, not billions, trillions of dollars worth of expensive real estate within a few feet of sea level. And you've got different challenges, whether it's the Marina or Treasure Island or the Cargill Salt Flats or whatever. If you don't erect some kind of berm or barrier or something like that, you're talking about the real estate and insurance industries going over the edge. So it's big deal.
Right. And one of the you know, you mentioned Houston and Miami. One of the things that I've heard about is that the actual spot of Ground Zero, where the two World Trade Center buildings were,
that
is this sacred land, sort of sacred patriotic land or something, that is one of the things that is, of course, Manhattan's most threatened part.
And it's just underwater.
Yeah, exactly. So let me ask you just a little bit personally, Kevin, about your evolution since 99 over this 10 years. In other words, at the time, you were doing fair trade, you were doing global exchange, you were writing books about it, but clearly with green festivals now in four cities and fair trade shops in a number of cities, and the work that you're talking about right now of you know, the meetings you're going to today are very different than the meetings you were going to 10 years ago. What has that personal evolution been?
Well, it was very interesting to see when it's a funny coincidence. I was in Seattle giving a talk at the University of Washington when we found out that Seattle had been picked as the city. And, you know, those of us who were organizing against the WTO, we figured when we heard that Clinton was bringing them to the U.S. for a meeting to try and launch a new round of negotiations, we figured they'd pick San Diego, Honolulu, someplace hard to get to or conservative. And when they picked Seattle, we were like, oh, my God, this is like the home of all the direct action forest struggle stuff of chaining yourself to trees and blocking bulldozers and all that kind of stuff. So, and the reason why they made that stupid choice was because Boeing and Microsoft wrote big fat checks.
There you go.
To lure them there. So, duh, you know, they were hoist on their own petard. So we immediately started activating all of our networks and getting on the phone and getting on the radio and saying, okay, come to Seattle at the end of November. You know, this is going to be huge. And we didn't know when we showed up in Seattle a week before the event, we weren't sure if the troops would show up. And then all of a sudden the streets just start to fill up with all these, mostly young people, but, you know, Japanese Buddhists and Oklahoma pig farmers and trade unionists from South Africa and all of these people. And we realized, oh, wow, we might be able to actually pull this off. And we tanked them in those 4 days of meetings. At the end of their meetings, they had nothing. They didn't have a press release. They didn't have an agreement. They had absolutely nothing. And a few years later, we did the same thing to them in Cancun, and they came out of the 4 days with nothing.
But let me ask one thing, because it seemed to me, and I was there both on the streets and in buildings because I was there as press. And yeah. I remember that night when they were, of course, well, just for people, you know, when you go to one of these big meetings, your intended protocol is that you've already got everything decided. You've got everything signed. You're just going through the motions for the photo ops and stuff, and then on the final day you release what you basically might have changed a few things about. But in this case, we knew at the start of that week they didn't have an agreement yet, and so that week actually called for business. And I can remember waiting in the hotel room where the press people would come out to us at 10, at 11, at midnight, and basically saying, we don't know when it'll be, we don't know when it'll be, and nothing came. Now, what I'm getting to is, you had this diverse group of activists on the streets, but you had the actions of the poor and developing nations in the meetings that came together perfectly. How much did you know that might happen on either side?
Well, the way I laid it out in our book, Globalize This, is it was the interaction between the street protests and the struggle internally between third world and first world governments, between the U.S. government and the European governments, and between, within, if you look at the politics, the kind of bureaucratic politics within those European countries, you had battles between the commerce trade minister and the environment minister. They were at odds with each other. So you had a lot of internal conflict. The major one between the global South countries, the former colonial countries, and the first world countries, because the way that these things typically work, like you said, you know, it gets worked out ahead of time. The rich countries get together in a green room off to the side. They work out the basic structure. Then they push it to the third world countries and say, okay, look, here's the way this deal is going to go. And they did that in Cancun as well. And third world countries are just fed up with it. In Cancun, the first government to walk out was Kenya. Kenya's a big recipient of U.S. foreign aid. There's a big U.S. naval base at Mombasa. You see, you're saying, wait a minute, why would they walk out? Because they were treated with such disrespect. In the one of the draft documents, they come out saying, oh, you know, you third world countries should diversify your agricultural products. The third world governments are saying, you morons, we had diversified agricultural products until you came in and colonized us and forced us to grow coffee, cotton, tea, and cocoa. So don't be telling us to diversify when you forced us to undiversify. So that kind of colonial racist arrogance blew up in their faces and caused internal contradictions. But it was our protest in the streets that sort of exacerbated it and I think stiffened the spine.
That's
of
what I'm
some
thinking.
Of these third world
elites. I mean, hardly shall the, you know, shall the kids in the street take the credit, but in a way I think that's probably true, is that we're standing up to them like we've always wanted to, and it feels like we're part of something bigger, even.
Yeah, because now, like, for example, coming off Seattle a few years later in Cancun, the governments of India, a right-wing government, Cuba, Venezuela, Mexico, Brazil, they were seeking us out. We had a huge coalition, and they were coming to us saying, hey, can you meet? Because they realized that we can put people on the street, whereas that's really hard for them. So that they saw a self-interest in being allied with the grassroots nonprofit groups.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange, founder of the Green Festivals, executive director of the Global Citizen Center, and a key organizer of the Seattle WTO teach-ins and protests. And you can learn more about Kevin's work, and there's a lot of good work going on at globalexchange.org, Global Citizen Center, globalacceptance.org and greenfestivals.org. I'll say them all one more time, and I'll say them again at the end of the show. Globalexchange.org, globalcitizencenter.org, greenfestivals.org.
And I should mention that on the Green Festivals site, they can stream audio and video of our speakers over the past 8 years, Amy Goodman, Cornel West, all these great people. And at the Global Citizen Center site, there are downloadable, free downloads of green job reports and green curriculum. Like if you wanted to do a course on greening a campus and developing a sustainability plan for campus, or if you wanted to be a chief environmental officer of an organization, what would you need to learn? And those curriculum are there free for people to download.
Very good, very good. Let me go back again to what do you sense, and we've sort of talked about it in terms of what happened in Cancun, but let me read you a quote from around the time. Actually, I read it to you in our interview in 2000, but I'll read it again. And then the long-term effects on globalization of what happened in Seattle and what continues to happen. Here's the quote. And today it sounds even more prophetic. Quote, there never was economic evidence in favor of capital market liberalization. There still isn't. It increases risk and doesn't increase growth. You'd think defenders of the liberalization would say to me by now, you haven't read these 10 studies. But they haven't, because there's not even one. There isn't the intellectual basis that you would have thought required for a major change in international rules. It was all based on ideology. And those were the words of Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist of the World Bank, who's become a lot more prominent in the 10 years since as well.
Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah, not at the time, I don't think, though, yeah.
Right.
So what has been the long-term effect? And if you want, fold in, we've got about five more minutes, fold in also the role of the current economic crisis.
Yeah. If you look at it broadest scale over hundreds of years, 500-600 years since capitalism sort of sprung forth out of northwestern Europe and took over the planet, we've had a system, a global system, where money values dominate the life cycle, whether that's human rights or the environment. And now we're making a transition to having life values dominate the money cycle. We're learning how to subordinate commerce and industry to life instead of subordinating life to commerce. And that's a long-term thing. But if you think about it in terms of Seattle, you have the WTO writing a constitution for the planet based on money values, but you have a whole massive amount of human rights legislation, international human rights treaties, the 1948 Universal Treaty on Human Rights, and you have a whole bunch of environmental laws as well, the Montreal protocols around ozone depletion and things like this. So you have two constitutional tracks going on, one representing money values and big corporations, the other representing life values backed by environmental groups and human rights, social justice groups. And if you say, okay, you know, on one side you got guns and money, and on the other side you've got facts and moral authority. Facts and moral authority are going to win in the long term. Dr. King said what will prevail in the end is unarmed truth and unconditional love. Those are much more powerful than guns and money. Guns and money are temporal. They dry up and blow away in the wind. So long term, we're going to win. And in fact, I would argue at the ideological, philosophical, spiritual, ethical level, we've already won. We've already won. If we put it out to a global vote, and we could probably do this technologically, and you said to people, should we subordinate life to commerce or should we subordinate commerce to life, we're going to win that vote. You know, just like if you said, should women have equality with men? Yeah, there'd be some recalcitrant morons that would vote against it, but most people would say, well, of course, just like racism is bad. We've come a long way in terms of consciousness, in terms of institutional power, and who's got the money and the guns. Yeah, we're still, you know, in the weaker position. But I think the greatest obstacle we face is the cult of powerlessness, is that voice in our heads that, oh, we can't really do this. Could we really do a global revolution? And that's where we're at. We're at in the early stages of the first ever global revolution. Every revolution up until now was a national revolution where the revolutionaries sought to gain control in the capital city to run that country differently. If you look at 1994, January 1st, when the Zapatistas rose up in southern Mexico, they didn't say, we want to seize power in Mexico City to run this country differently. They rose up against the neoliberal corporate model that was starving their children and cutting down their forests, and they said, we'd rather die on our feet than live on our knees. We're gonna change this. And the Mexican military at the time had the ability to crush them, but there was so much international solidarity that sprung forth supporting the Zapatistas and opposing the Mexican military, that they had to back off and let them survive. So that, you know, that marks a turning point that says to people, okay, look, we've got to shift our culture within the left from protest, which we're great at saying no, what we're against, to create the next system. The Titanic is sinking, and we should not focus on running around the decks. This boat sucks. We should build the next boat, a party boat, party on deck, scantily clad people with drinks in their hand, dancing to cool music, pull up alongside the Titanic. People are going to jump. And that's why we do the green festivals, to show people. I'd love to do a green festival next to a Republican Party convention. And where would the defectors go? They wouldn't go from us to them, that's for sure. Because we've got a better model. It's more sustainable. The existing system is not sustainable. And you're even seeing now big corporations starting to take on sustainability, realizing that there's no profit in a burnt cinder of a planet where people are starving, you know? So you're starting to see change. People like us getting, I'm working with people here in city government who are just as radical as me, and maybe even more so, because they're starting to wake up and see we can't keep going the way we've been going.
Very good. I got to end it there. I've been speaking with Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange, founder of the Green Festivals, executive director of the Global Citizen Center, author of Building the Green Economy. You can learn more at globalexchange.org, globalcitizencenter.org, greenfestivals.org, and I really recommend you go there and get in on, as we heard, this global revolution. Thank you, Kevin Danaher. As always, keep up your good work.
My pleasure.
Okay. Also, thanks to our first guest, Norm Stamper, Seattle's police chief during those events in 99. Stamper's written the book Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing, a book I highly recommend. He's become a prominent spokesman for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You're going to learn more at normstamper.com and at LEAP, LEAP.cc. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, transcripts, and join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally, one word, .net. And if you want to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about and a little background on those issues, email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally at Mac.com.